We're talking with Joel Barker. You can find out more about him at joelbarker.com. His new book explores the five regions of the future as he sees it. And it's a very interesting discussion about technologies and what exactly that means, different ways of looking at technologies as ecosystems and how they will impact us. He is the man responsible for the popularization of the term paradigm and paradigm shift. Joel, I actually experienced an interesting experience in paradigm shifting tonight. I went to a concert at the XL Energy Center. I saw a country artist that I'd never heard before. I'd heard of him, a guy named Keith Urban, okay? Which, by the way, was one of the best shows I've ever seen. It was terrific. And I'm not a big country guy, but it was great. It was more rock and roll than it was country, and it was just a terrific show. So at one point, people were expressing their great love and admiration for him, and they were holding up those glow sticks that you pay cash money for to wave to the artist, right?
Yep.
And I, remembering that I had brought my pipe in my bag recently, I had my lighter, my pipe lighter with me. So I reached into my bag and I pulled out my pipe lighter and I lit it. Well, I mean, there were, you know, a couple thousand glow sticks and one guy with a lighter. When I was going to concerts, you know, the first time around in high school, everybody, I didn't even smoke and I brought a lighter with me. Everybody had to have a lighter because you wanted to light up the whole building with the, you know, make it look like the night sky with everybody holding up their Bics.
Yep.
And the reaction around me when I held up the lighter, it was really interesting. It kind of freaked a couple people out because the high tech thing with the glow sticks or medium tech or however we look at that. But I mean, by compared to a flame, it that's safe and knowable and comforting somehow. When I held up an open flame, there were two people in the row in front of me. They must have jumped 4 feet. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting that people would have that reaction around that at a concert.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they had a fearful reaction, almost like I was going to light something or that something I was going to try and burn something, not just, you know, the good old fashioned hold up a lighter at a concert routine.
Yeah.
I just wanted to shake them and say, it's okay. You know, yeah. It's just a lighter. But that just goes to show you that sometimes things just move and you have to kind of understand how the world is moving around you. And that brings us back to this idea about some of the things that you as a futurist are kind of intimidated by, things that kind of you're looking over your shoulder thinking about. And one of those is super bugs. And we kind of just started talking about it a little bit. Yeah. Did we get to everything you wanted to on that?
Well, I can say a couple more things about it, but I do want to say one other thing. Scott Erickson is the co-author of Five Regions of the Future, and we don't want to leave him out.
Yeah, we do. He's not on. Who cares? He's not on. He's not here.
We got to give him credit. He wrote two of the five regions.
All right. Well, we'll give him, this is it then. Yeah, we've given him his credit.
We gave him his credit now.
For the rest of the show, he's out.
And we're back to Nature Tech, actually, when we're talking about this. That is the region I wrote about because it is the hottest of the regions because of our ability to manipulate DNA. But Mother Nature manipulates DNA pretty well, too, and that's what the superbugs are about. We've got the flesh-eating bugs, which are pretty scary. You know, these are bacteria that just like to digest us. And if they get started, they are very difficult to stop because we do not have good antibiotics for them. And in fact, it comes back to the song you're playing when it comes back, one thing leads to another. These bugs wouldn't be there were it not for SuperTech because the SuperTech technology figured they could just take care of anything that Mother Nature threw at it with. We'll just hit it with more antibiotics. All we did is train a bunch of bugs to be able to eat the antibiotics as their kind of their side dish,
right?
And then eat us as a main dish,
as a garnish.
Exactly, it's a good way to think about it.
Condiment.
I'm going to have a little streptomycin here, you know. I'm going to have a little bit of, you know, because it tastes good. So we now have these bugs that are phenomenally more powerful than they were before, and we could have actually handled them with much simpler devices. The other deal that comes along with this is these antibiotics. We're excreting, you know, we take too much of it, then we pee. It goes out our urine, it gets into the waterways, and so we're actually flooding the waterways with these training devices. I mean, if you want to think about it that way, to train these bacteria to be more strong. So I'm really concerned about that. One of the places it could very well go, by the way, I listed on my little list that I sent to you, was plastic-eating bugs. We don't have them yet, but we do have bugs that are eating the precursors of plastics.
What does that mean, eating the precursors of plastics?
The chemicals that we combine into the plastics themselves. So right now we're saying, oh, good, we'll get this bug to eat this because that'll reduce our pollution. That we're really training that bug to get toward plastic. Now, let's just think about it for a minute. If bugs actually started eating plastic, how many things do we count on that are made out of plastic that all of a sudden you'd have to be scrubbing them down and doing all sorts of, because they're being eaten by these bacteria? So that's kind of the next stage, and we better be very careful because we don't want them to be trained, or we're going to have to change a lot of stuff in our society.
Don't we think that the military is already doing that?
Well, you know, there is, I call it the myth of the military. You know, the military is way ahead on everything. The
right.
military's got flying saucers. The military's already got faster than the speed of light things. Maybe they do, but my guess is not, because it's not that easy. That's part of the myth that, they'll do it, but they won't tell us about it. A lot of this stuff is very tricky, and that's why I worry less about some things than other things, because of just how Mother Nature is also very complex. And so to create these bugs, it's more likely Mother Nature is going to do it than we're going to do it, to be very honest with you.
Well, it seems like a good place to stop then and come back and talk about some other events, which I think you put into the category of unlikely.
Yeah.
But I want to explore them anyway.
Yep.
The things that are on the low end of the probability scale,
yep.
but that would seem to me, and I'm not a futurist, but if they ever did happen, that would put them on the highest end of the disruptibility scale.
Yes.
Because we would be so totally unprepared for those things which are out in left field. And we'll explore just what's on that list. What's lurking out there past shortstop next? Sea to Sea, we're Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. At the beginning of this conversation with Joel Barker, we talked about how, as a futurist, he had to consider the worst-case scenarios in order to talk about things which were more likely to happen. But he had to know kind of just sort of a baseline of what could all possibly go wrong as a way to try to judge both how he could advise a company how to avoid it, but also to anticipate what would be more likely scenarios and how to get ahead of them. So let's talk about some of the least likely events, one of which I've hardly heard about, this methane burp. I mean, I've got two boys, 12 and 14, so I'm a little familiar with methane,
yeah.
but not in that delivery system. What do you mean by that?
Well, this list we're going to go through now is what I call unlikely, highly disruptive, and almost unstoppable events. I mean, it's one of those things where you're saying, it's an you know what, but there's nothing you can do about it. Methane burp. We know for a fact that there are methane hydrates, which are basically compressed methane gas all over the deep areas of the ocean around the world. Lots of methane there, by the way. In fact, it's considered by some as a fuel source. If we go down and bring the methane up in controlled processes, you can burn it. It's a very good gaseous fuel. Okay, but here's the dilemma. If it comes up as a burp, that is, if something heats that ice up at the bottom of the ocean so that it, in fact, expands rapidly, it can move in huge volumes into the atmosphere, and methane is 20 times better greenhouse gas than CO2. So we have a potential sitting at the ocean's bottoms. Now, I understand you're going to have somebody come talk about volcanoes at the bottom of the sea.
Well, we've talked about this a little bit, yeah.
Okay, you've done that. Well, there's your heat. There's your heat source. And so it is literally, if it happens, you can't go and say, oh, let's capture all of that. I mean, it's gone. It's a done deal. All of a sudden, you have that in the atmosphere. The other piece that goes with that, by the way, is the Siberian frozen tundra is thawing out right now for the first time in just about recorded history. I mean, if you look back in Russian history, they don't have any record of this. And one of the things that's coming along with the thawing is release of methane. So this methane risk for the greenhouse effect is a little scary because it could trigger a runaway greenhouse effect. And that could be as much as another 5 to 10 degrees average up, which would make a phenomenal difference in the way this planet runs.
Well, doesn't that bring us back to this more of these super hurricanes then? If the Gulf waters are already the kind of perfect breeding ground for strong Category 3, 4, and 5 hurricanes, then what happens when the warm waters around the equator get that much hotter?
See, there you go thinking in systems again, Ian. That's exactly it's a feedback loop, and it fits all the other things. The other thing we know, by the way, is that also that even in the tropics, there's an upper range of temperature that the tropical forests can handle before they start functioning substantially less effectively in absorbing carbon dioxide. So there are these nasty components here that we need to think about in order to say, are we going to be casual about this global warming thing? We're going to get real serious about handling it.
So let's play that a little bit more then, because we're talking about glaciers.
Yep.
We're talking about everything then, if it's affected by global warming, we'll see more calving of giant glaciers.
Yep.
We'll see a rise in the sea level.
Yep.
Right? So that will turn what are already coastal communities like New Orleans will make it even more perilous for them to remain under sea level when sea level gets higher, and they don't.
Yeah, add another 10 feet to sea level and see what you get in New Orleans.
Okay, well, then what are the likelihoods of something like that happening, and how would American business respond to it? 10 feet rise in sea level, what is that going to do to offshore drilling? Where would we get our energy then? Would that be the end of petroleum?
No, because offshore drilling, it's a floating device. It won't make any difference for offshore.
Okay.
You just put another 10 feet of pipe on it. What the problem is something you can't lift. Miami Beach, Savannah,
right.
New Orleans, Galveston, New York City. What is an extra 10 or 15 feet do for New York City, for Boston? You know, it really does change the coastline. Bangladesh, I mean, you're taking out living space for millions of people just like that. We have islands that just go under on that.
How much warning would we have?
Well, there's two scenarios. See? So one scenario is it's going to take all century for the melt. What we know is the ocean has been absorbing a lot of the heat. It also will take a long time to release it, so let's stop the CO2 and the oceans will cool off in the next couple of years. It'll probably be a couple of decades for that. And by the way, there is one important thing to say here. The glacial melt actually started before we had substantial added CO2. So something else had started the glaciers melting. You know, people say, oh, it's all about CO2 and about global warming. Well, global warming, if you look at the glacier melt, started before the CO2 concentrations went up. But, you know, one of the scenarios that is very interesting, it has to do with the glaciers sitting on the Antarctic continent. You know, in the North Pole, it's floating in the water. So if it melts,
right,
it makes a little bit of change. But if you get enough water lubricant underneath those, you could theoretically have large chunks of the glaciers sliding off into the oceans. And that's like you getting into a bathtub. The water level goes up fast. So that's one of the worst-case scenarios that, again, if it happens, you can't go down and say, stop.
Right.
You know, it's going to slide into the ocean.
We don't have any technology prepared to hold them together, too, right? I mean, we're not working on giant Antarctic Band-Aids or staples.
The scale is so phenomenal. If you think about this, it's the size of the Connecticut kinds of chunks of ice. You know, that just dwarfs anything humans can think about.
Yeah, it does. And so what else do we see around the world that would give us a model of that kind of disaster? Have we ever seen anything like that?
Oh, well, I suppose what happened to the Netherlands back in, what, I think it was the 50s, when they had the North Sea come crashing over their dikes and flooding a substantial portion of their country and killing a lot of their countrymen. You know, that they re-engineered their dikes, but they're very much at risk again. If the water goes up, if it goes up, you know, a meter or 2 meters, that's just a huge amount of water that they'll have to deal with.
What are you referring to when you talk about the Canary Island slippage?
Oh, that's the one that made me move from Florida. I mean, now this is silly, but I really did. I looked at that. I turned to my wife. She had wanted to come back to Minnesota because we've got 6 grandchildren here. She said, "Shouldn't we go back and see the grandchildren?" And I studied this. I said, "Yeah, I think we should."
Did you tell her this was why?
Yeah, actually, I did. I actually was trying to design some technology that would protect me from that. By the way, we can talk about that in a minute if you want. But here's the story.
Protect you from having to tell your wife the truth?
No, to get us the hell out of here.
Oh, okay.
The tidal wave.
I didn't know when the tsunami came. Wasn't sure what you were referring to. It was some technology that would keep you from saying something to your wife. Because if you come up with that, let me know.
I will.
I'll use one of those too.
There's nothing that I can think of that would do that. If you Google this, by the way, Canary Islands, you get the stories right off the bat. But the research goes like this. Some people are studying the islands, and they notice that there was a very large slippage. A good portion of the island basically fell into the ocean. Well, when a big chunk of land goes from the air to the ocean, it displaces a substantial amount of water. And it turns out the displacement would start with a tsunami, I think the height of about 350 to 400 feet, moving at about 500 miles an hour.
Holy smokes!
Now, it's moving across the Atlantic. When it gets to New York and Baltimore and Boston and the whole eastern coast, it's still 150 feet high, moving at 500 miles an hour. If you're in Florida, it's going to basically wash across Florida. Okay. Now, here's the deal. If it slips, again, you can't say, well, what should we do next week? Because at 500 miles an hour, it's going to be there in a couple of hours. And everybody's going to know it, by the way. The Canary Islands have slipped. The wave is coming. Pray. Or if you have, what I was actually designed was a hot air balloon hidden in my garage with a boat on the bottom of it. And fuel that thing up and get the hell up about 20,000 feet or 15,000 feet as much as I could, because it's going to be driving a huge wind wall in front of it too. So you don't want to be anywhere near that 500 mile an hour wind wall that it's pushing as well.
Now, wait a second. No, you said you were designing that. You didn't actually have one.
No, I said, if we're going to stay here.
Okay. That's
I'm
fine.
I'm going to put this together because this is one of these, it's called an insurance policy. If I never use it, happy days. But I sure as heck don't want to have a wall coming at me that's going to be there in 4 hours and I have nowhere to go in 4 hours, you know, and just simply say, well, that's it. I'm dead. You know, so at least I was trying to think of some way to solve the problem. But it was simpler to get to the 1,500-foot mark and come back to St. Paul, Minnesota, where I don't think the waves will get us. But that's one of those where you literally, as a human being, you have no scale response. There's nothing you can do. It will wash through New York City. It will wash through Baltimore. It'll probably end up 20, 30 miles inland, you know, halfway up the Appalachian walls. And ask yourself, what are the implications for a business, for the economy, for the world economy of the East Coast of America disappearing?
Well, and that's such an, especially the speed and the size, because we saw how high was the tsunami that affected the Pacific Rim? How many?
15, 20 feet,
and traveling at how fast? I don't think anybody mentioned anything about 500 miles an hour.
No, 30, 40 miles an hour best, I'm sure.
Right. So something that large breaking off the Canary Island slippage, I mean, that's just unheard of. We just don't have any.
Breathtaking. And the thing is, they did the math. These are not foolish people. These are scientists studying. Now, there's one group of scientists who say it won't break off as a chunk. It's going to break in little pieces, and therefore we'll never have a problem with it. That's a good middle-of-the-road scenario, and I'm happy to see that scenario. But you also have to think about, well, what if it didn't? What if, in fact, the volcanic action of the Canary Islands cracked that baby and it all came at once?
And what would happen if you didn't have a boat attached to a hot air balloon in your garage? If you just didn't happen to have one of those? Well, you know,
you
moved back to Minnesota. A lot of people from Louisiana are moving to Minnesota. I'm not throwing this as a pitch out for state tourism, but it is interesting, and I want to have you address it if you would, because I think a lot of people around the country are unaware of the atmospheric changes in Minnesota as well, and how the climate has been changing here. And it kind of echoes a little bit about what you're talking about with Siberia. So I'll ask Joel Barker to address that amongst the other subjects we have remaining on the unlikely events scenario for one futurist next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with Joel Barker, futurist and author. The Five Regions of the Future is his new book, and you can find out more on that at fiveregionsofthefuture.com. We've been talking about some of the things as a futurist he would rather not consider, some of the things he really can't prepare the business community to either A, anticipate, or B, survive. You know, let's hope you're not teaching them how to make money off of some of these things, because it's just a horrible thing to contemplate. But except that we can mention that, because you talked about moving up from Florida and some of the worst case scenarios about the weather along our coasts, that you moved back to Minnesota. And I think people who hear about Minnesota, and commonly when I tell people this is where I live now, they'll all say the same thing. Oh, you must get, you know, 20 feet of snow every year or whatever. And the interesting thing is actually there's almost no snow that comes to Minnesota anymore. I mean, you hear some of the old timers talk about the days of snow in Minnesota, and there, most people that live in Minnesota love the snow, and they have all sorts of vehicles that they've paid big money for. They're making monthly payments on to use in the snow and to play with them on ice and to go ice fishing. And the ice fishing season shrinks every year, and there are fewer and fewer decent snowfalls to use all this fun stuff that be all the toys that people have.
Yeah. I grew up in Minnesota and lived here until I was 45, and then my wife and I headed to Florida because we wanted to not deal with the harsh winters. Now that we're back this year for the first time, and we are already noticing how much longer the fall is and how much warmer it is, I'm not sure that that's a trend yet, because we've only been back now for 6 months, or not even 6 months, for 3 months. You know better than we do, because you've been around the last couple of years. It sounds like you have noticed a milder Minnesota.
Well, you know, go ahead and talk to the people who sell Ski-Doos. The people who are selling snowmobiles of any time. They're just, it's harder and harder to sell them. People use them less and less. Ice fishing last year was another great example of this, where literally, I mean, you have people that have these wonderful ice houses that they put out on the lake so that they can fish in the winter, and they're very elaborate and they're marvelous, and they drive their pickup trucks out to their ice houses. And last year was the second year in a row that they had almost an emergency pull-off of these ice houses, because the melting came so much faster than people thought, and the season was over. They already lost, they were losing pickup trucks left and right of people who were going out to get their ice houses back.
Well, so, we were in Florida at that time, but so I missed that news. But it tells you that there seems to be a trend of warmer, more northerly locations. And we know what's happening in Siberia is an anomaly, historical anomaly, in terms of lakes appearing in Siberia because of the melt being so successful, that the permafrost is actually thawing out. So it's clearly things are happening. Clearly some aspect of global warming is occurring. And whether we are the total cause or not, I believe that human beings have accelerated the warming trend. And that's the real problem. If it took place over 200 or 300 years, everything would adjust appropriately. If it takes over the place of several decades, our natural systems have a much harder time responding. We know that the polar bears right now are just not getting enough food because of how quickly the ice floes are melting in the spring
right.
and the summer.
And then they're discovering all these new species that they never knew existed as the northern polar cap shrinks, and they're able to go into these areas they've never been in before, which is great for, you know, cryptozoology fans like me, because I love finding new things. And in fact, there's an article about that in the current After Dark newsletter, which you can grab if you log on to coasttocoastam.com. Well, loss of diversity, then I think this is a good discussion. Since we're talking about the oceans, we'll come back with this and we'll talk about the diversity theories that you have. Like, what's the good kind of diversity and the wrong kind of diversity in our ecosystems and in our technicologies, as Joel Barker would call them, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oh, before I forget, too, I'm supposed to remember David Jackson to you. A conversation I had earlier in the week. Yeah, we're talking with Joel Barker, who has some of the best-selling business books of all time. Also, two of the best business films slash videos of all time, number one and two on the list. And it all started with his discussions about paradigms and paradigm shifts in the 1970s. And it's each one of those videos cost $900. Could somebody just link up and buy one on your website if they want to?
They can.
After they arrange a home loan, then they can.
That's right.
Is there a famous star in it or anything? I mean, do you have Jennifer Lopez? Do you have, who's in it for $900?
Me.
Okay, are you dancing?
I wrote it and I hosted it.
Are you singing in it for $900?
No, I'm giving really important ideas, clear explanation. And that's, you got to have both of those things. You have to have important ideas, you have to really explain them well, and then people will pay that kind of money for it.
So it's pretty much you and a dry erase board
for
$900.
No, actually, I set a style. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Jacob Bronowski doing The Ascent of Man, where he...
Oh, I do.
Okay,
right.
Well, I looked at that film. I said, that's what I'm going to do for business films. And everybody said, that's crazy. Nobody cares whether you go to the place. Turns out everybody cares. And so I'm at Machu Picchu talking about diversity. And I'm at Auschwitz talking about the power of vision and how it brought people through the horrible experience at Auschwitz. They're actually beautiful films. I had a great filmmaker who really could capture the essence of those places.
Well, for $900, do you at least talk with a British accent?
I try to, but it doesn't work.
Here on the plains of England, we see. All right, so let's talk about diversity and Machu Picchu and explain how you're. I mean, we hear diversity now in kind of mostly in a human resources context, right. But you see it in a very different way.
Way bigger than that. Way bigger than that. And let me frame it, first of all, within the ecological, we're worried about big concerns. My big concern is the loss of diversity in the natural system, because every time a creature disappears, we have an extinction. We've basically lost a huge package of information, and there's almost guaranteed to be at least one gift in there that human beings could really use. I mean, just think about botulism. I mean, you get crazy, botulism, that kills you. No, actually, it can relax muscles from people who have, see, people don't know about this. If you have lockjaw,
sure.
Inject botulism into that muscle, and it releases the jaw so you can eat and stay alive. If you know how to use Mother Nature's gifts, everything that dies is a gift. So as we cause these extinctions and lose diversity, we're doing a really stupid thing.
Well, but isn't botulism what they make Botox out of?
It is also, okay. But I didn't want to mention that because that's kind of like, okay, that's, it's a gift,
that'd be a
I
good
guess.
Thing, wouldn't it? We say if we didn't have any more botulism, we wouldn't have any more aging starlets with permanent quizzical expressions on their faces.
Yeah, with an inability to smile or make
that's
wrinkles
right.
in their face.
Permanently startled look on their face.
Yeah, that's right.
But what you're saying is that, and explain what you mean about gifts, because I think that's an interesting idea. Everything has a gift.
Every living creature has figured out how to live a long time, to survive, to be around. So when we do stupid things like wiping them out by knocking out their niche, we don't, unless we've done our research, we don't know what they had to offer us. There are bacteria that eat pollutants and excrete hydrogen. That would actually be a fairly important gift to use, There are butterflies have in their scales a technique for producing an extremely deep black has nothing to do with the color black. It captures the light and doesn't let it get out. So we could learn from that. There's just so much that we could learn from that we lose when we, you know, the dodo bird probably had a lot to teach us, but we'll never know because it's gone.
And so that makes us more of the same.
Everything
within an ecosystem, then we limit the diversity, then we create just a smaller range of gifts.
We homogenize the world. And a homogeneous world is a world that is very dangerous. And it's very dangerous because let's go to the human homogenization, okay? The globalization, the flattening of the world, big mistake. And here's why. If you and I think alike, because we have been homogenized and we've been globalized, that if we run into an interesting problem, my solution is the same one you're going to come up with because we're homogenized. But if we are different, your solution will be different than mine. And as a matter of fact, you and me working together, utilizing our differences, not our similarities, will increase the likelihood that we will come up with a clever solution. Mother Nature calls it mutualism. Mutualism is bringing differences together to solve significant problems. And the cool thing about mutualism is you stay who you are, I stay who I am. It's the differences that we each carry that we share and work together to solve these problems. So diversity is, in fact, the key to innovation, both in Mother Nature and in human culture. Homogenization is a dangerous thing because you stop coming up with novel solutions.
Well, this goes back to something you mentioned to me earlier in the week when we were talking on the phone about where does innovation come from?
Yes.
And it doesn't explain the whole, was it tigers or what were you talking about?
Yeah. The question that I asked, and I do this when I'm working with my audience, is I say, okay, I'm going to give you a situation. You tell me where you're going to expect to find the most innovation. We have an ecosystem working from the edge into the center, which is the edge least competition, the center the most competition. Okay, given what you know, what you've been taught in school, where do you expect to see the fastest rate of radical innovation? And the classic answer is, well, where the competition is greatest. Because we've been taught Darwin and competition brings out these new ideas. Turns out that's not true at all. Not true in Mother Nature and not true with human beings either. Okay? Turns out that where the competition is greatest, what you get is incremental innovation. That is little innovations. And the reason you get little innovations is because if you try a big one and it fails in a highly competitive environment, you get eaten. You're dead. But if you go out to the edge of the ecosystem, where that ecosystem meets another ecosystem, that's where you have the fewest competitors. You can try something out there. If it doesn't work, who cares? You can try something else. You're safer out there. Plus, you get this other thing, and it's the verge. A verge is where something and something different meet. I mentioned that earlier tonight, okay? A verge is where something and something different, it's where two ecosystems meet. And it turns out that the stimulus of the differences in the other ecosystem will trigger you to try new things and kind of process the world differently. Let me give you an example. It's absolutely connected to KSDP, okay, because you guys have got iPods. When the iPod was invented, you have to ask, who did it, and where did they do it? Well, it was a company called Apple, and Apple was big into computers, I believe, right?
Right.
But they didn't say, let's go to the heart of the competitive computer system. We'll compete with Hewlett-Packard and Dell. And
right.
They went out to the edge of the system. They said, you know, we've got this computer technology, this really teeny little disk, and some really great software. If we look just on the other side, there's the entertainment industry over there. And there's a whole bunch of assets over there that we could, in fact, deploy into our technology and do something nobody else has done, iPod, right? So they took the music from the entertainment industry, they took their software and their hardware from the computer industry and created a huge new basis for wealth. Remember I said new wealth comes from innovations? Well, we weren't spending money on iPods until Apple came around. All of a sudden, I mean, billions of dollars have been spent on this technology. Here's the thing. If Apple had failed with iPod, would their computer business fail?
Right.
It wouldn't have. See, it didn't make any difference to them because they were safe where they were trying it out. And this is the power of diversity, to take differences and combine them into new combinations and create things that could not exist otherwise.
And the inverse of that is with the success of the iPod, they've been able to underwrite their less successful computer market and try to create new products there. I thought it was interesting when I went into I was looking at an iBook last year, and they their big marketing tool was buy an iBook and you get a free iPod. And they were using the lure of the iPod to get you to buy their computers, not the other way around.
Very cool. Very cool, because then I would say what they've done is reconnected back to their high level competition,
right,
and are actually using a lever that the others can't offer.
Well, when is diversity ever wrong then? Wouldn't more diversity always mean more success?
That's what I thought too, until I got deep into the research on diversity. For a long time I said, it looks like infinite diversity is a great deal, but then there's this really interesting condition that screws it up. If you take a look at all ecosystems, and in our five regions of the future, we talk about these technological ecosystems. Even at the base there, you must have a common thread. So if you're a coral ecosystem, there has to be a common thread there. In that case, it's the ocean's waters. It's seawater, okay? If you're a prairie ecosystem, it's the soil that everything grows on. If it's a cultural ecosystem, it's the language. It's the fact that we can communicate at some level and that we have at least some core set of values that we agree upon. Then we diversify from that. And so it turns out if you have too much diversity so that you lose the language and capacity, and let me go back to the ecosystem. What if we had three different kinds of DNA on the planet? Then you couldn't have that common thread of DNA that's running through all living things. But we have that, and because we have that, it allows for, at a base, a commonality that ties us all together as we grow in our differences. So one of the concerns I have about the United States is the balkanization of our language, where we're starting to say to teachers, no, you're not going to teach in the English language anymore. You're going to teach in this language or that language, because that's what the kids speak in, because they're immigrants. I believe we should be saying to all our immigrants, hey, guess what? We've got this wonderful six-month program where we're going to teach you to speak English and read English and write English so that you have the common thread of the American ecosystem so you can participate in all the advantages and benefits of this ecosystem.
But that doesn't mean they have to abandon the other language. In fact,
no,
because we spend a lot of time with English-speaking kids teaching them foreign languages.
And that's exactly. See, you want a bilingual, trilingual, quadrilingual. In that school I was talking about, the EFG school, we talk six languages simultaneously to the kids, and they loved it. They thought that was really cool. It's 1 month they're speaking in Japanese, and 1 month they're speaking in Russian, 1 month they're speaking in German. They didn't say, what are we doing? We said, hey, you need that kind of language skill to, in fact, understand things you can't understand otherwise. So it's not take away one and put the other. Keep your language that you're speaking now. That's great, but you must also learn the common language of the culture and of the nation, because we want you full participant. You can't be a full participant without that skill of language.
There's so many things we haven't gotten to yet, but one piece I want to see if we can sneak in here now real quickly, and then maybe the rest will just pop up when we're taking questions coming up next hour for Joel Barker, futurist and author, is going back to where we started in this conversation about kids and science and the school, for example, that you yep. worked on, where you made a big emphasis on math and science part of the curriculum, yep. Is that we have dreams of going back to colonize the moon or to colonize space,
yep.
but are we really prepared for that as a culture? And what happens if we don't?
It's one of the great questions, I think, of the 21st century. And that is, can we actually practically go into outer space? In the book, Five Regions of the Future, we talk about the super technologists, the super techers, and that really outer space is their domain. But it takes a lot of energy right now. It takes a lot of energy to get there. We have to figure out a practical way to get into outer space if we are going to reap those benefits. And I for one, think it's very, very important because, in fact, you had this conversation with somebody else also, I think, earlier, on asteroid strikes and meteorite strikes, that if you think about it, human beings have, for as long as we've known in history, have always talked about us flying. And I'm even crazy enough to suggest that we as a species were birthed and sped up by the planetary ecosystem, and basically given we're embedded with the need to fly, because the only way you can protect this planet is getting off the planet and intercepting those things before we get here. And so it is going to be a big issue, and it's going to be a big challenge, because I think we need, if we're going to protect the planet for the duration, the next million years, we need to be off planet to do that.
We can't get stuck on the island.
Exactly.
We'll take it up from there. We'll give you all the phone numbers you need so that you can join in the conversation. Whenever you talk with a futurist, you can always muse about possibilities. And if there is a particular interest you've heard so far, or maybe one we haven't brought up yet, I look forward to hearing where you're going to take us next on Coast to Coast AM with Joel Barker.